This is a special recording, The Count of Monte Cristo. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, my name is Kelly Wall from North Carolina Reading Service. I will be reading for Harrison 2 from The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexander Dumas, translated and with an introduction and notes by Robin Buss. Chapter 25. The Stranger. Day broke. Dantes had been waiting for it for a long time. At the sun's first rays, he got up and, as he had done on the previous day, climbed to the highest point on the island to look around. As before, everything was deserted. Edmond went down, lifted the rock, filled his pockets with precious stones, and replaced the boards and the iron bindings of the casket as best he could. Then he covered it with earth, which he trampled down and scattered with sand to make the newly turned soil look similar to the rest. He went out of the cave, replaced the entrance, piled stones of various sizes around it, put earth into the gaps, planted myrtle and heather in them, and watered these new plants to make them seem well established. Finally, he covered the traces of his footprints around the spot and waited impatiently for the return of his companions. There was no sense now in spending his time looking at this gold and these diamonds, and staying on Monte Cristo like a dragon guarding a useless treasure. He must return to life and take his place among men and in society, with the rank, influence, and power that are bestowed in this world by wealth, that first and greatest of forces that a human being can control. The smugglers returned on the sixth day. From afar, Dantes recognized the Jean Amelie by its cut and its gait. It was limping into port like a wounded Philoctetes. When his companion stepped ashore, Dantes told him that he was considerably better, though he continued to complain. Then in turn, he listened to the smugglers' tales. They had certainly been successful, but hardly had the cargo been offloaded than they learned that a brig of the excise from Toulon had just left harbor and was heading in their direction. They took flight at once, regretting that Dantes, who knew how to get so much greater speed out of the vessel, was not there to guide them. The following boat soon came into view, but they managed to escape under cover of night and by rounding the cap course. In short, the voyage had not been unsuccessful, and everyone, particularly Jacopo, expressed regret that Dantes had not been with them, so that he could have his share of the profits they had brought back, a share which amounted to 50 piastres. Edmond remained impassive. He did not even smile when they emphasized how much he would have benefited by leaving the island. And since the Jean Amelie had called at Monte Cristo only to pick him up, he embarked the same evening and went with the boat to Leghorn. There he went to visit a Jew and sold four of his smallest diamonds for 5,000 francs apiece. The Jew might have inquired how a mere seaman came into possession of such things, but he was careful not to ask. He was making 1,000 francs on each diamond. The next day, Dantes bought a new boat, which he gave to Jacopo, together with 100 piastres, so that he can engage a crew, all on condition that Jacopo went to Marseilles and asked for news of an old man called Louis Dantes, living in the Allées de Melhan, and a young woman from the Catalan village named Mercedes. Now it was Jacopo's turn to think he was dreaming. Edmond told him that he had become a sailor on an impulse, because his family would not give him money to support himself, but that on arriving in Leghorn, he had received a bequest from an uncle who had made him his sole heir. This story seemed plausible enough in view of Dante's superior upbringing, and Jacopo did not for a moment doubt that his former comrade had told him the truth. In addition, since Edmond's contract of service with the Jean Amelie had ended, he said farewell to the master, who at first tried to dissuade him, but, having learnt the same story as Jacopo about the inheritance, abandoned hope of overcoming his former employee's resolve. The next day, Jacopo set sail for Marseilles. He was to pick Edmond up on Monte Cristo. The same day, Dantès himself left without saying where he was going. Bidding farewell to the crew of the Jean Amélie with a splendid present and to the master with the promise that he would hear from him again one day. Dantès was going to Genoa. He arrived at the moment when they were testing a little yacht ordered by an Englishman, who, having heard it said that the Genoese were the best boat builders in the Mediterranean, had decided to have a yacht built there. He had settled on a price of 40,000 francs. Dantès offered 60 on condition that the boat was delivered to him that same day. The Englishman had gone on a trip to Switzerland while the boat was being completed. He was not due to return for 3 weeks or a month. So the boat builder reckoned he would have time to start building another. Dantès took him to a Jewish banker, who led them behind a shop and counted out 60,000 francs for the boat builder. The latter offered Dantès his services to find a crew, but Dantès thanked him and said that he was used to sailing by himself and that the only thing he wanted was for the man to build him, in the cabin behind the bed, a secret cupboard with 3 hidden compartments in it. He gave the measurements for the compartments, and they were completed by the following day. 2 hours later, Dantès sailed out of Genoa, followed by the stares of a crowd of inquisitive onlookers who wanted to see the Spanish gentleman who was in the habit of sailing on his own. He succeeded brilliantly with the help of the rudder, and without needing to leave it, he put his boat through its paces so that it seemed like an intelligent being, ready to obey the slightest command. Silently, Dantès agreed that Genoese deserved the reputation as the finest boat builders in the world. The crowd looked after the little ship until it was out of sight, then fell to discussing where it was going. Some said Corsica, others Elba. There were those ready to bet that he was heading for Spain, but some argued, just as warmly, that he was en route for Africa. No one thought to mention the island of Monte Cristo. Dantès was bound for Monte Cristo. He reached the island around the end of the second day. The ship handled superbly, and he had covered the distance in 35 hours. He recognized every inch of the coast, and instead of making for the usual port, he dropped anchor in the little creek. The island was deserted. No one appeared to have landed there since Dantès was last there. He went to his treasure. Everything was just as he left it. By the next day, his huge fortune has been transported onto the yacht and shut up in the 3 secret compartments of the hidden cupboard. He waited another week. During this time, he sailed his yacht around the island, studying it as a horseman studies his mount. By the end, he knew all its qualities and its defects and had promised himself to enhance the former and remedy the latter. On the 8th day, he saw a little ship sailing at full speed towards the island and recognized Jacopo's vessel. He made a signal, Jacopo replied, and 2 hours later, the ship had drawn alongside the yacht. There was bad news in reply to both Edmond's questions. Old Dantès was dead. Mercedes had vanished. Edmond's face remained impassive as he listened to this information, but he immediately disembarked, not allowing anyone to follow him. 2 hours later, he returned. 2 men from Jacopo's vessel joined him on his yacht to help him sail it, and he gave orders to make for Marseille. He was not surprised at the death of his father. But what had become of Mercedes? Edmond had not been able to give detailed enough instructions to another party without divulging his secret. In any event, there was further information that he wanted to obtain and for which he could rely only on himself. His mirror had informed him in Leghorn that he ran no danger of being recognized, and moreover, he now had at his disposal every means to disguise himself. So, one morning, the yacht, followed by the little ship, sailed proudly into the port of Marseille and stopped directly in front of the place from which, on that fatal evening, they had set sail for the Chateau d'If. Dantès shuddered a little at the sight of a gendarme being rowed out towards him. But with the perfect self-assurance that he had acquired, he handed over an English passport, which he had bought in Leghorn. With this foreign document, far more highly respected in France than our own, he had no difficulty in landing. The first person he saw when he set foot on the Canabar was a sailor who had served under him on the Pharaon, as if placed there to reassure Dantes as to the changes which had taken place in him. He went straight up to the man and asked him a number of questions, to which he replied without the slightest hint in his words or his expression that he recalled ever having seen the man who was talking to him. Dantes gave the sailor a coin to thank him for the information, only to hear the man running after him a moment later. He turned around. "Excuse me, monsieur," the sailor said. "You must have made a mistake. You doubtless thought you were giving me 40 sous, but in reality, this is a double Napoleon." "Yes, indeed, my friend," said Dantes. "I was mistaken. But as your honesty deserves a reward, here is a second coin which I beg you to accept, and drink to my health with your friends." The sailor looked at Edmond in such astonishment that he did not even consider thanking him, but watched him walk away, saying, "Here's some nabob straight off the boat from India." Dantes carried on, but every step he took brought new emotion to his heart. All his childhood memories, those memories that are never effaced, but remain ever present in one's thoughts, lay here, rising up from each street corner, in every square, and at every crossroads. When he reached the end of the Rue de Nemours and saw the Allée de Meilhan, he felt his knees give way and nearly fell under the wheels of a carriage. At last he reached the house in which he had lived with his father. There were stock clothes, and the nasturtiums had vanished from the attic roof where the old man's hand used once to trellis them so carefully. He leaned against a tree and stayed for a while, thinking and looking up at the top floor of the mean little house. Finally went across to the door, stepped inside, and asked if there was no lodging vacant. Even though it was occupied, he insisted on going to visit the one on the fifth floor, until finally the concierge agreed to go up and ask the people living in it whether a stranger could take a look at their two rooms. The little lodging was inhabited by a young man and woman who had been married only a week. When he saw this young couple, Dantes gave a deep sigh. As it happened, there was nothing to remind Dantes of his father's apartment. The wallpaper had changed, and all the old furniture, Edmond's childhood friends, which he recalled in every detail, had disappeared. Only the walls were the same. He turned towards the bed, which the new tenants had kept in the same place. Involuntarily, his eyes filled with tears. This was where the old man must have expired, with his son's name on his lips. The young couple looked in astonishment at the stern-faced man, down whose otherwise impassive cheeks two large tears were falling. But as every sorrow inspires some awe, they did not question the stranger, but stepped back to let him weep at his ease. When he left, they went with him to the door and told him that he could come back whenever he wished. There would always be a welcome in their humble abode. Reaching the floor below, Edmond paused in front of another door and asked if the tailor, Caderousse, lived there. But the concierge told him that the person he mentioned had failed in business and now kept a little inn on the Bellegarde Road in Beaucaire. Dantes went down to the street, asked for the address of the owner of the house in the Allée de Meilhan, went to visit him, and was announced as Lord Wilmore, which was the name and title on his passport. He bought the house for 25,000 francs, which is at least 10,000 more than it was worth. But if it had stood at 500,000, Dantes would have bought it for that. The same day, the young couple on the fifth floor were informed by the notary who had drawn up the contract that the new owner was offering them any apartment in the house at no additional rent, provided they would let him have the two rooms that they then occupied. These strange events preoccupied all the regulars in the Allée de Meilhan for more than a week and were the subject of 1,000 conjectures, none of which proved correct. But what muddled everyone and confused every mind was that, on the same evening, the same man who had been seen going into the house in the Allée de Meilhan was observed walking in the little Catalan village and going into a poor fisherman's house, where he stayed for more than an hour, asking for news of several people who were either dead or who had vanished more than 15 or 16 years earlier. Next day, the people among them whom he had made these inquiries received a present of a brand new Catalan boat with two seine nets and a trawl net. The good people would have liked to thank the generous inquirer, but he had not been seen, after leaving them, giving orders to a sailor, mounting a horse, and leaving Marseille through the Port d'Ac. Chapter 26. At the sign of the Pont de Garde. Those who have walked across the south of France, as I have done, may have noticed an inn situated between Bellegarde and Beaucaire, roughly halfway between the village and the town, though rather closer to Beaucaire than to Bellegarde, outside which hangs a crude painting of the Pont de Garde on a metal plate which creaks on the slightest breath of wind. This little inn, lying parallel to the course of the Rhone, is situated on the left side of the road with its back to the river. It was what in Languedoc is described as a garden, that is to say, the side opposite the one through which travelers enter overlooks an enclosure in which a few stunted olive trees lurk beside some wild figs, their leaves silvered with dust. Between them, the only vegetables that grow here are some heads of garlic, some peppers, and some shallots. Finally, in one corner, like a forgotten sentry, a tall umbrella pine rises in melancholy fashion on its pliable trunk, while its crest, fanned out, blisters under 30 degrees of sunshine. All these trees, large or small, are naturally bent in the direction of the Mistral, one of the three scourges of Provence. The two others, as you may or may not know, being the River Durance and Parliament. Here and there, in the surrounding plain, which is like a great lake of dust, stand a few stalks of wheat that the farmers hereabouts must surely grow out of mere curiosity. There is a cicada perched on every one of these stalks, which pursues any traveler who has strayed into this wilderness with its high-pitched, monotonous call. For perhaps the last 7 or 8 years, this little inn had been kept by a man and woman whose only staff were a chambermaid called Trinette and a stable boy answering to the name of Picard. In fact, these two assistants had amply sufficed for the task, since a canal between Beaucaire and Aigues-Mortes had ensured the victory of water over road haulage, and barges had taken the place of the stagecoach. As if to torment still further the unfortunate innkeeper, who was ruined by it, the canal ran between the Rhone, which supplied it with water, and the road, which it drained of traffic, only some 100 yards from the inn, which have been briefly but accurately described. The innkeeper was a man of 40 to 45, tall, dry, nervous, a typical southerner, with his deep-set shining eyes, his hooked nose, and his teeth as white as those of some beast of prey. Though his hair had felt the first breath of age, it could not make up its mind to go gray, like the beard that he wore following the line of his jaw. It was thick, curly, and spattered with just a few strands of white. His complexion, naturally swarthy, was covered by yet a new layer of brown, from the habit he had adopted of standing from morning to night on the threshold of his door to see if some customer might not arrive, either on foot or by carriage. His expectations were almost invariably disappointed, but he stood there still, with no protection against the burning heat of the sun, other than a red handkerchief knotted about his head like a Spanish mule driver. This man was our old acquaintance, Gaspard Cateros. His wife, in contrast, whose maiden name had been Madeleine Riddell, was pale, thin, and sickly. She came from the region around Arles that had been preserved some traces of the traditional beauty of the women of that area, while seeing her future slowly deteriorate, ravaged by one of those persistent fevers which are so common among the peoples who who live near the ponds of Ogmortz and the swamps of the Camargue. In consequence, she spent most of the time seated, shivering, in her room on the first floor, either stretched out in an armchair or leaning against her bed, while her husband kept his customary watch at the door. He was all the more happy to spend his time there, since whenever he found himself in the same room as his better, or certainly bitter half, she would harass him with unending lamentations on her fate, to which her husband would normally only respond with these philosophical words, "Quiet, la car cant, it is God's will." The nickname, derived from the fact that Madeleine Radel had been born in the village of La Carconte between Salon and Lambesc. So, in accordance with local custom, by which people are almost always given a nickname in place of their names, her husband had substituted this for Madeleine, which was probably too soft and pleasant sounding for his rough tongue. However, it should not be thought that the innkeeper, despite this pretense of resignation to the decrees of fate, was not acutely sensible of the poverty to which he had been reduced by the confounded Beaucaire canal, or that he was proof against the endless complaints that his wife heaped on him. Like all Southerners, he was moderate, needing little for himself, but vain when it came to external matters. So in the days of his prosperity, he would not let a farade or a procession of the Tarasques go past without appearing in it, La Carconte at his side. He would be dressed in his picturesque costume of a man from the Midi, somewhere between Catalan and Andalusian dress, while she would have on the delightful attire of the women of Arles, suggested of Greece and Arabia. Little by little, however, watch chains, necklaces, gaudy belts, embroidered blouses, velvet jackets, elegantly trimmed stockings, multicolored gaiters, and silver buckled shoes had vanished until Gaspard Caderousse could no longer appear in his former splendor. So on his own behalf and that of his wife, he gave up all these worldly exhibitions, though he felt a bitter pang when the happy sounds of some celebration would reach this miserable inn, which he kept much more to have a roof over his head than as a business proposition. As was his custom, Caderousse had spent part of the morning standing at the door, turning his sad eyes from a little bare patch of grass where some hens were pecking to each end of the empty road, which extended southwards in one direction, northwards in the other. Suddenly his wife's sour voice called him away from the post. He went inside, grumbling, and up to the first floor, while leaving the door wide open as if to persuade travelers not to forget him as they went by. When Caderousse turned back into the house, the main road down which, as we said, he had been looking, was as empty and lonely as a desert on the midday sky. White and endless, it ran between two lines of slender trees, and it was quite reasonable to suppose that no traveler who was free to choose any other hour of the day would wish to venture into this awful Sahara. However, if he had remained at his post, Caderousse would have seen, defying probability, a horse and rider approaching from Bellegarde with that frank and friendly manner which suggests the best possible understanding between the horseman and his mount. The horse was a gelding, which ambled pleasantly along. On its back was a priest, dressed in black and wearing a three-cornered hat, despite the blistering heat of the sun, which was now at its zenith. The pair proceeded at a very sensible trot. When they reached the door, they stopped. It would have been difficult to decide whether it was the horse that stopped the man or the man who stopped the horse. In any event, the rider dismounted and, leading the horse by its bridle, attached it to the knob of a dilapidated shutter that was hanging by a single hinge. The priest then went across to the door, wiping his dripping brow with a red cotton handkerchief, and knocked three times with the iron tip of his cane. A large black dog immediately got up and took a few steps forward, barking and baring its sharp white teeth. The show of hostility only demonstrated how unused it was to receiving company. At once, the wooden stairway running along the wall shook with a heavy tread. the landlord of the mean lodging house at whose door the priest was standing was coming down, bent over, and walking backwards. "Here I am," Caderousse said in astonishment. "Here I am. Be quiet, Margotin. Don't worry, monsieur. He barks, but he doesn't bite. Would you like some wine? How hot it is. It's a right little strumpet of a day. Oh, I beg your pardon," he said when he saw what kind of traveler this was. "I didn't know whom I had the honor to serve. What can I get you? What would you like, Monsieur l'Abbé? I am at your command." The priest looked at the man for 2 or 3 seconds with unusual concentration, even appearing to want to draw the innkeeper's attention to himself. Then, since the other's face expressed nothing but surprise at not having an answer to his question, the newcomer decided it was time to put an end to the delay and said, with a very heavy Italian accent, "Aren't you Monsieur Caderousse?" "Yes, sir," the innkeeper said, perhaps even more surprised by the question than he had been by the silence which preceded it. "I am indeed Gaspard Caderousse, at your service." "Gaspard Caderousse. Yes, I think that is the name. Did you once live in the Allées de Meilhan on the 4th floor? "That is correct." "Were you exercised the profession of tailor?" "Yes, but the profession went downhill. It's so hot in that damn Marseille that I honestly believe in the end, people, there won't be dress at all." "But talking of heat, wouldn't you like to take some refreshment, Monsieur l'Abbé?" "Certainly. Bring me a bottle of your best wine. Then we can carry on the conversation where we left off, if you would be so good." "However you like, Monsieur l'Abbé," said Caderousse, and, not wishing to miss the opportunity of selling one of the last bottles of Cather's wine that remained to him, he hastened to lift a trapdoor in the boards of the same ground floor room, which served as both dining room and kitchen. When he reappeared, 5 minutes later, he found the Abbé sitting on a stool, with his elbow on a long table, while Margotin's scrawny neck rested on his thigh, and the dog was looking at him with a languid eye, apparently having made his peace with this unusual traveler, when he understood that, contrary to custom, he was going to partake of refreshment. "Are you alone?" the Abbé asked his host, who put a bottle and glass in front of him. "My God, yes, or almost, Monsieur l'Abbé. I have my wife, who can't help me at all because she's always ill. Poor Carcante." "Ah, you are married?" the priest said, with some interest, looking around as if assessing the meager value of the couple's poor furniture. "You are thinking that I'm not rich, eh, Monsieur l'Abbé?" Caderousse said with a sigh. "What do you expect? It is not enough to be honest to prosper in this world." The Abbé stared hard at him. "Yes, honest. That I can boast of, Monsieur," the innkeeper said, returning his stare with one hand on his heart and nodding his head. "And nowadays not everyone can say as much." "So much the better, if what you boast of is true," said the Abbé, "because I am convinced that sooner or later a righteous man is rewarded and a wicked one punished." "You're a man of the cloth, Monsieur l'Abbé," said Caderousse with a bitter look, "and it's your job to say that. But everyone is free to disbelieve what you claim." "You are wrong to say that, Monsieur," said the Abbé, "for I myself may well be, in your own case, the proof of what I am saying." "How do you mean?" asked Caderousse in astonishment. "I mean that I must first of all ensure that you are the person I think you are." "What proof can I give you?" "Did you, in 1814 or 1815, know a sailor called Dantès?" "Dantès. Yes, I knew poor Edmond. I certainly knew him. He was one of my best friends," Caderousse exclaimed, his face turning deep purple, while the Abbé's clear, confident eyes seemed to dilate and embrace every detail of the man opposite him. "Yes, I do believe he was called Edmond." "He certainly was. I should know, if anyone. Edmond was his name as sure as my name is Gaspard Caderousse." "But what happened to him, monsieur? To poor Edmond?" the innkeeper continued. "Did you know him? Is he still alive? Is he free? Is he happy?" "He died a prisoner, more forlorn and despondent than the convicts who wear their shackles in the penal colony in Toulon. The redness which had first swept over Caderousse's face was replaced by a deathly pallor. He turned aside, and the abbé saw him wipe away a tear with a corner of the red handkerchief that he wore to cover his head. "The poor boy," Caderousse muttered. "Well, that just goes to show what I was saying, Monsieur l'Abbé. The good Lord is only good to the wicked." "Ah," he went on, with the exaggerated language usual to Southerners, "the world is going from bad to worse. If only the sky would rain gunpowder for 2 days and fire for an hour, and we could all have done with it all." "You seem to have sincerely attached to the young man, monsieur," said the abbé. "I was indeed," said Caderousse, "though I have to confess that for a moment I did envy him his good fortune. Since then, I swear on the honor of a Caderousse, I truly pitied him his terrible fate." There was a moment's silence, during which the abbé continued to direct a penetrating gaze at the innkeeper's changing expression. "And did you know him, this poor lad?" Caderousse went on. "I was called to his deathbed to offer him the last rites of the church," the abbé replied. "And how did he die?" Caderousse asked, in a barely audible voice. "Of prison itself. How else do you die in prison when you are 30 years old? Caderousse wiped the sweat off his streaming brow. "What is odd in all this," said the abbé, "is that Dantès, on his deathbed, as he kissed the feet of the crucifix, always swore to me that he did not know the true reason for his imprisonment." "That's true, that's true," Caderousse muttered. "There was no way he could know. No, Monsieur l'Abbé, the poor young man was not lying. And it was for that reason that he asked me to find out the truth about this misfortune, on which he himself unable to shed any light, and to rehabilitate his name, if it had been blackened in any way." The abbé's gaze became increasingly fixed on the almost grim look that spread over Caderousse's face. "A rich Englishman," he continued, "his companion in misfortune, was released from prison at the Second Restoration and owned a diamond of considerable worth. When he was ill, Dantès had cared for him like a brother, and when he left prison, he wanted to give some token of his gratitude by leaving Dantès this diamond. Instead of using it to bribe his jailers, who might in any case have taken it and afterwards betrayed him, he kept it preciously in the hope that he might be released. If he was, the sale of the single diamond would ensure his fortune." "So you are saying," Caderousse asked, his eyes lighting up, "that this was a very valuable stone?" "Everything is relative," the abbé answered. "Very valuable to Edmond. Its worth was estimated to 50,000 francs. 50,000 francs, Caderousse exclaimed. "It must have been as big as a walnut." "Not quite," said the abbé, "but you can judge for yourself, because I have it with me." Caderousse seemed to be looking straight through the abbé's clothes for the object. The abbé took a small, black, shagreen box out of his pocket, opened it, and displayed before Caderousse's astonished eyes the shining jewel set on a finely wrought ring. "This is worth 50,000 francs? "Without the setting, which it is itself quite valuable," said the abbé. As he closed the box and returned the diamond to his pocket, though it continued to shine in Caderousse's head. "But how did you come into possession of this diamond, Monsieur l'Abbé?" he asked. "Did Edmond make you his heir?" "No, but the executor of his will. I had 3 good friends and a fiancé," he told me. "I am sure that all 4 of them must feel my loss bitterly. One of those good friends was called Caderousse." Caderousse shuddered. "The other," the abbé went on, appearing not to notice Caderousse's reaction, "was called Danglars. And the 3rd, he added, "even though he was my rival, also loved me." A diabolical smile passed over Caderousse's face, and he made it as if to interrupt the speaker. "Wait," said the abbé, "let me finish. Then if you have any remarks to make, you can do so later. The 3rd, even though he was my rival, also loved me. He was called Fernand. As for my fiancée, her name was..." "I don't remember the fiancé's name," said the abbé. "Mercedes," said Caderousse, Mercedes. That's it, the abbé agreed, suppressing a sigh. Well, said Caderousse, give me a jug of water, said the abbé. Caderousse hastened to do as he was asked. The abbé poured himself some water and took a few sips. Now, where were we? He asked, putting down the glass. The fiancée was called Mercedes. That's right. You will go to Marseille. It's still Dante speaking. You understand? Absolutely. You will sell this diamond, divide the proceeds into five, and share them among these good friends, the only creatures on earth who ever loved me. Why five shares, said Caderousse. You mentioned only four people. Because the fifth is dead, or so they tell me. The fifth was Dante's father. Alas, yes, said Caderousse, torn between conflicting feelings. Alas, yes, poor man, he died. I learned this in Marseille, the abbé replied, making an effort to appear unconcerned. But the event took place so long ago that I could learn nothing further about it. Do you happen to know anything about the man's end? Who could know better than I, said Caderousse. I lived right next door to him. Heaven help us. It was hardly a year after his son's disappearance that the old man died. What did he die of? The doctors called it gastroenteritis, I think. Those who knew him said he died of grief. But I almost saw him die myself, I would say that he died. Caderousse paused. Died of what? The priest repeated anxiously. To tell the truth, of starvation. Starvation, cried the abbé, leaping up from his stool. Starvation? The lowest creature does not die of starvation. Even a dog roaming the streets may find a pitying hand to throw it a crust of bread. Yet you say this man, a Christian, died of hunger in the midst of other men who also call themselves Christians? Impossible. It's impossible. I only know what I know, Caderousse said. And you are wrong, said a voice from the staircase. What has it to do with you? The two men turned and saw La Carconte's sickly features staring through the banisters. She had dragged herself down to the foot of the staircase and was listening to their conversation, sitting on the stair with her head on her knees. And what has it to do with you, wife? Asked Caderousse. The gentleman wants some information. It's only polite to give it to him. Yes, it's only common sense to refuse. Who says what his purpose is in making you talk, you idiot? An excellent purpose, madame, I promise you, said the abbé. Your husband has nothing to fear as long as he answers me frankly. Ha! Huh, nothing to fear? They always start with fine promises, then afterwards tell you that you have nothing to fear. Then off they go, without keeping their word, and one fine morning misfortune comes to poor people, without them knowing where it comes from. Have no fear, my good woman. No misfortune will come to you from me. I guarantee it. La Carconte muttered a few inaudible words, let her head fall back to her knees, and continued to shiver feverishly, leaving her husband free to continue the conversation, but seated in such a way that she would not miss a word. Meanwhile, the abbé had taken a few more sips of water and recovered his composure. But, he went on, was this poor old man so totally abandoned by everyone that he could die in such a manner? Ah, monsieur, said Caderousse, it's not that either Mercedes the Catalan or Monsieur Morel abandoned him, but the poor old man had taken a profound antipathy to Fernand, the very person, he added, smiling ironically, that Dantès told you was one of his friends. He was not? Asked the abbé. Gaspard, the woman muttered from the top of the stairs. Mind what you say. Caderousse made an impatient gesture, and with no other reply to the woman who had interrupted him, told the abbé, can anyone be the friend of a man whose wife he covets? Dantès, who had a heart of gold, called all those people his friends. Poor Edmond. After all, it is better that he knew nothing. He would have found it too hard to forgive them on his deathbed. Whatever anyone says, Caderousse concluded, with a kind of rough poetry in his speech, I am still more afraid of a dead man's curse than a living man's hatred. Idiot, said La Carconte. "Do you know what Fernand did to harm Dantès, then?" asked the abbé. "Indeed I do. Tell me." "Gaspard, you can do as you wish. You are the master here," said his wife. "But if you take my advice, you'll say nothing." "This time I think you may be right, woman," said Caderousse. "So you don't want to tell me?" the abbé continued. "What is the use? If the lad was alive, and if he came to me to tell him, once and for all, who were his friends and who were his enemies, then I might do it. But he is dead and gone, so you say. He can feel hatred no longer, nor can he take revenge. Let's draw the blind on all this. So you want me to give these people, who you tell me are unworthy and false friends, a gift that he was meant to reward their fidelity?" "That's true. You're right," said Caderousse. "In any case, what would poor Edmond's bequest be to them now? A drop of water in the ocean, apart from which those people could crush you with a flick of the hand," said his wife. "What do you mean? Have they become rich and powerful then? Don't you know what happened to them?" "No. Tell me." Caderousse seemed to reflect for a short time. Then he said, "No. In fact, the story is too long." "You are quite at liberty to keep it to yourself," the abbé said, with an air of the most profound indifference. "If so, I shall respect any reservations you may have. Indeed, you are showing yourself to be a truly generous man, so let's say no more about it. The duty that I have to carry out is a mere formality. I shall sell the diamond." He took it out of his pocket, opened the box, and displayed the shining stone before Caderousse's eyes. "Come and see it, wife," the innkeeper said, his voice breaking. "A diamond," said La Carconte, getting up and walking quite resolutely down the stairs. "What is this diamond, then?" "Didn't you hear? It's a diamond that the boy left us, first of all to his father, then to his three friends, Fernand, Danglars, and myself, and to his wife, Mercedes. It's worth 50,000 francs." "Ah, what a lovely thing," she exclaimed. "So, 1/5 of the amount belongs to us?" Caderousse asked. "Yes, monsieur, plus Dante's father's share, which I feel I have the right to divide among the four of you." "But why among four?" asked La Carconte. "Because the four of you were Edmund's friends." "Traitors are not friends," the woman muttered grimly. "Yes, just so," said Caderousse. "I was only saying as much. It's almost blasphemy, almost sacrilegious, to reward treachery or even crime." "That's what you wanted," the abbé continued calmly, putting the diamond back into his cassock pocket. "Now give me the address of Edmund's friends so that I can carry out his last wishes. Sweat was pouring down Caderousse's forehead. He saw the abbé get up and go towards the door, as if to make sure that his horse was waiting before coming back. Caderousse and his wife exchanged an indescribable look. "The diamond would belong to us alone," Caderousse said. "Do you think so?" his wife replied. "A man of the cloth would not try to deceive us." "As you wish. I am having nothing to do with it." She returned, shivering, to the staircase. Her teeth were chattering, despite the burning heat of the day. On the top step, she paused and said, "Think about it, Gaspard." "I've made up my mind," said Caderousse. La Carconte went back to her room with a sigh. The ceiling creaked under her feet until she reached her armchair and let herself fall heavily into it. "What have you decided to do?" asked the abbé. "To tell you everything." "Quite honestly, I think that's best," said the priest. "Not that I want to know anything that you want to hide from me, but if you can help me to distribute the bequest in accordance with the wishes of the departed, that will be best." "I hope so," Caderousse replied, his cheeks flushed with greed and expectation. "I am listening," said the abbé. "One moment," said Caderousse. "We might be interrupted at the most interesting point, which would be a pity. In any case, it's better that no one knows you have been here." He went across to the door of the inn and closed it, putting the bolt across it as an extra precaution. Meanwhile, the abbé had chosen a place from which he could listen in comfort. He was sitting in a corner in such a way as to be in shadow, why the light fell full on the face of whoever was opposite him. His head bowed, his hands folded, or rather clasped together, he prepared to give all his attention to the story. Caderousse drew up a stool and sat down opposite the abbé. "Remember, I'm not forcing you," said the quavering voice of La Carconte, as if she had observed the setting of the scene through the floor of the room. "Agreed, agreed," said Caderousse. "Say no more about it. I take full responsibility." And he began his tale. We've run out of time for this hour of The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas, translated by Robin Buss. We'll pick up right where we left off in the next episode. My name is Kelly Wall from North Carolina Reading Service, providing news and information for individuals who are blind or print impaired. Our website is ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or concerns or comments, please call 919-832-5138.